Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Bruna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything, available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Hello all, and welcome to Most Notorious. It's so great to have Thomas E. Stevens with me. He is the principal writer and researcher for Think History, a podcast produced by the Kentucky Humanities Council through WEKU-FM in Richmond, Kentucky. He is the author of Civil War Game Changers, Kentucky and Kentuckians in America's Bloodiest Conflict, True Bluegrass Stories, History from the Heart of Kentucky, and First Cats, Amazing Origins of the UK Sports Tradition. And he is here today to talk about a grudge that grew and grew until it turned fatal for one of the parties involved. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
So you have a very special connection to this story. Could you tell us about it? What got you interested in it?
Well, I had a great uncle who was a judge in Louisville, Kentucky, and he was well connected to the story. It was about his great uncle, who in the family we called Colonel Dave. Colonel Dave was a congressman, a lawyer, an investor. He was sort of the point man for the English investors who built Middlesbrough, Kentucky, which was designed to be a copy of Middlesbrough, England, and to mine coal and send that abroad. So they put, I think, Barings Bank of London put $20 million in 1888 dollars into the project and built Middlesbrough, Kentucky, over a little village called Yellow Creek in Bell County. And they also built several places just south in Tennessee. And I would listen to him talk about this story and always wondered about it. And when I got into public history in the 1990s, I began researching it. And it took me about 3 years to put it together. And it was much more interesting and vicious and tragic than I ever knew.
Right. And this was published as an article, right?
Yeah. It appeared in the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society in 2000. It was called Congressman David Grant Colson and the Tragedy of the 4th Kentucky Volunteer Infantry.
So the United States has quite a history of dueling, the Hamilton-Burr duel being the most famous of them. And while they lost popularity towards the end of the 19th century, people were still dueling, especially in the South, where a gentleman's honor remained important to some.
That's true, because one of the principals did not have honor because he ambushed his former colonel, who had arraigned him in court during his court-martial for insubordination and a variety of other charges.
Yeah, I definitely want to ask you about that, the origin of the feud. But if you don't mind, let's talk first about David Grant Colson, his background, his political career, and how he came to become a colonel during the Spanish-American War.
Well, Colson was 38 years old. He was an attorney. He was the point man for his family's land sales to English investors who built the city of Middlesbrough in the 1890s. So a lot of money poured into the family. They retained one city block of Middlesbrough, and they made money that way, but also, I assume, investing the money that they had gotten from Barings Bank in London. He was an attorney, a real estate investor, a coal operator. He was a Middlesbrough mayor and considered to be the leader of the youthful wing of his Republican Party in Kentucky, which was in its infancy as a in an effort to compete with Democrats. Kentucky had just elected its first Republican governor in William O. Bradley. And it was thought that Colson would succeed Bradley as governor.
Right. And as far as his role in the
yes.
war.
So it was said that the nation whooped to war in the summer of 1898, spring and summer, to free the native population of Cuba from Spain. And it was widely reported that the population was virtually behind barbed wire. And people like Theodore Roosevelt and many others, former Confederate officer named Joe Wheeler from Alabama was also in Congress. And when Roosevelt left his position in Washington to be the colonel of the Rough Riders, kind of a wave of martial spirit ran through Congress, and Colson got swept up in it, as did Wheeler. Wheeler ended up being Roosevelt's commanding officer in Cuba, and later Colson's in Alabama. So Colson left his seat in Congress to try to get a regiment, which he eventually did with the 4th Kentucky Volunteer Infantry in the summer of 1898.
So how did he help put this regiment together? How did he choose his officers? And how did this man named Ethelbert Scott manage to secure a position under him?
So if you were to try to find a fatal flaw in this process, it was that politics entered the consideration for people. There were members of the 4th Kentucky from all over the country, and even a man from Switzerland. But it was mainly the counties in which Colson represented as a congressman. Many attorneys, the newspapers were anxious to come up with a Rough Rider type moniker for the 4th, and they came up with Mountain Men. And I argued that it could also be called the Fighting Attorneys because of the sheer number. I believe 13 captains were attorneys, many lieutenants, many on the command staff, sons of Louisville's mayor, Kentucky's adjutant general, and three nephews of the governor, William Bradley. And one of them, Second Lieutenant Edwin Porch Morrow, was a future governor of Kentucky. Another of Bradley's nephews was Ethelbert Dudley Scott, who was a 29 years old. He was an attorney. He was on the outs with the governor, and the governor, who had the power to appoint officers, advised Colson not to appoint Scott. But because Scott had helped him in his congressional race in 1892, Colson said, "I'm going to appoint him anyway. I want him appointed." And he became a lieutenant in the regiment. He was very friendly. They were considered to be chummy, as the newspaper said, in the first several weeks of organization in Lexington. But before he left Lexington, Scott was already disobeying orders and being absent without leave and going into Lexington's watering holes, let's say.
Yeah, Colson was not happy with Scott. Scott didn't march with his men more than once or twice.
According to his captain, yes, that's true.
And he was drinking a lot, too.
Right. And, you know, let's face it, you know, young men and this was considered to be an adventure. And, you know, there was a lot of alcohol involved in these antics. I think Colson was very proud of the regiment. He felt that they were equal to the Rough Riders. He didn't think that anybody could outshoot them, for example. He said there's not in one in 50, but them who knows how to handle a gun and handle it to effect. And he said they don't know the manual of arms, but they will soon learn it, and it will not affect their shooting. Kentuckians had that reputation, and I think they tried to live up to that.
So how did the tensions begin between the two? How did the trouble start?
It doesn't start with Colson. The regiment mustered in July. It left. And this is one of the problems. The 4th probably should never have mustered because the Rough Riders had already done their thing in Cuba, captured the San Juan Heights on July 1st. And by the time the 4th got to Alabama, outside of Camp Ship, which is outside of Anniston, Alabama, the peace treaty had already been signed between the United States and Spain. So the best that the 4th could hope for, or Colson could hope for, was garrison duty in Puerto Rico or Cuba. But Scott was already refusing to perform his duties by the time they got to to Alabama. And the first time he got in trouble was with the commanding general, who directed him to show up to Board of Survey meetings, which was his duty, and they wanted to show cause why he failed to do so. So I believe that he was put up on charges of conduct unbecoming an officer after he beat a fellow officer, an Alabama officer, in Anniston, and he was acquitted for being absent without leave. So he scraped by in the first problem with military justice.
Right. So Scott sits outside of Colson's tent, and he mocks him within hearing distance.
Yeah, the quote is, he would lounge in front of the colonel's tent telling funny stories and cracking jokes at his expense.
Right.
And then, a few days later, he's being treated for gonorrhea. He's court-martialed in December, and fellow nephews of the governor testified against him, and Colson had his life threatened by Scott over those proceedings. He was convicted, and according to the War Department telegram that was received at the 4th, he was discharged. So it seems like an end to the problem.
But of course it's not, right? So Scott goes to Washington, makes it his mission to badmouth Colson every chance he gets, and he knows that Colson, more than anything, wants to take his regiment into battle. So he does everything in his power to get the 4th Kentucky mustered out.
Right, and he wanted to, Colson wanted that glory that Roosevelt was getting, and I'm sure there was a political motivation, as there was for Roosevelt. And Scott knew that he could take that away from him, but he knew people in the War Department, and he was able to get everything countermanded. He was able to get the 4th put on the muster out list, and he was able to come back to Anniston being reinstated. So Colson kind of knew what he was up against. He took his own trip to Washington to try to help his cause, and he stopped off in Middlesboro on his way to prepare his affairs, telling people that he wasn't sure that he would come back alive.
So there are two camps, basically, that start forming.
Yes, and so we have players on both sides. We have Colson and many of the officers, and then we have a company commander whose name was Benjamin B. Golden, his lieutenant, R.L. Blakeman, and Scott, who were trying to get as many of the privates who were for mustering out on their side as possible. And they succeeded. As a matter of fact, Scott had 1,000 buttons with his likeness made, And then he handed them out to the men, and they were beginning to put them on their uniforms by the time Coulson returned to Anniston.
And accusations are flying. Coulson and his camp claim Scott is fraternizing with enlisted men, that he's associating with men of low character, right?
Yeah, there were counter charges and counter charges in the newspapers, and that just made it more in line with the old time feud situation, where if my honor is questioned, then I'm going to defend it, and it just got worse and worse, you know, fueled I believe by alcohol. Even after he came back for duty in Anniston, he feigned an illness, stayed in a hotel there, and he was quoted as saying, "Coulson has the cards stacked now, but if we ever get back to Kentucky, I intend to kill him."
So the mustering out proceeds. Men begin boarding trains.
And it's important to note that the officers refused to ride home with the men on the rail cars, because so many of them had been threatened if they took off their uniform, the men were going to get them. There's a lot more men than there are officers in a regiment. And so they stayed behind to be mustered out after the men were. So the men were on their way back to Kentucky by the time the officers were being mustered out in downtown Anniston. And it was a complete breakdown in discipline. Of course, the men were by themselves in this train. They shot up the train. They shot at people along the way. They shot at cows. They shot at other men on other freight trains. I believe one of the quotes is, all along the road, men fired at freight trains and their crews. Nobody seemed to try to make the rascals behave themselves. So that was going on. And at the same time, it was already being covered in the nation's newspapers. The day of the officer muster out, February 11th, 1899, the Atlanta Constitution's headline was, "Regiment will be mustered out today, and the angry gentlemen may meet and fight." And then the Cincinnati Enquirer said, "Both men known to be absolutely fearless, and shooting was expected on sight."
Goodness, that ratchets up the tension even more, right?
Right. And Coulson entered what was called Percy Olmsted's Mammoth Restaurant that evening with a former major and former lieutenant in tow. And before he had sat down, he had been insulted by Blakeman, who was on that Scott side. And Coulson called him a damn scoundrel and apparently pulled his ear, lifting him from the chair. And Scott pulled out a .38 revolver at a distance of 5 feet and shot Coulson in the hip. As soon as that happened, as Coulson was struggling to get up, he was beaten unconscious by members of the provost guard.
And it takes a while for help to come, right?
Yeah, the Anniston police refused to respond. No one was arrested. Coulson was taken upstairs, had the bullet taken out of his hip, and Coulson's friends believed it to be an ambush, which included the provost guard and their part in it. Coulson had family members, you know, getting on a train, trying to get to Anniston as soon as they could, and trying to help him survive this. When Coulson had the opportunity to press charges, he refused. And that is another old-time honor situation where you're not going to give someone the satisfaction of complaining to anybody about a man's actions. You're just going to hold him to account yourself.
Right. The injury was serious enough that it slowed him down. And there was even some temporary partial paralysis.
Yes. And he went home. He had a convalescence. He tried to get back into the law. He was a special judge in a murder case, as was Golden, in the same county at the same time. Golden, incidentally, was elected Bell County Commonwealth's attorney, which is the a county prosecutor. So he was the arbiter of the law in Bell County at the time when right after this was going on. And Colson stayed away from the nominating process for governor that summer. And many people believe that he would have been nominated for governor had he not stayed away.
We will be back after these brief messages.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Some of us love history. Others used to or never did because history was presented as nothing but the rote memorization of names, dates, and facts. Basically, the story got left out, and that made history kind of suck. My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a university professor with a PhD in history, and bringing history to life is my passion. That's why I created my podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. I want to teach you everything you need to know about U.S. history, but I do so through stories. Let me tell you about George Washington begging his men not to mutiny against Congress. Clara Barton saving Union soldiers amid enemy fire. Enslaved Frederick Douglass risking his life for liberty. And about so many other figures as their real experiences make industrialization, social movements, and even congressional debates and tax policy come to life. Subscribe to History That Doesn't Suck today. And join me, Professor Greg Jackson, every other week for a new episode where I'd like to tell you a story.
And we have returned. So here comes this uncomfortable period. and by the way, Colson hadn't run for re-election.
Well, he was actually removed. He chose not to run again, but he had already relinquished his seat. Congress declared the seats open for the several congressmen who had left, and so they had special elections to fill those seats. So Colson was already out. There was another sitting congressman in his spot, and so he declined. He was just going to, I assume, run for something else at some point, but people thought that it would be governor. But he didn't want to be in the same place where Scott was during this period.
Right. And that's the difficult thing, correct? They're both active in the Republican Party.
Yes.
They work with the same people, attend the same party functions. Do they try and avoid each other? How does that go?
Well, Colson was advised to just go about his business. If he ran into him, he did. If he, you know, so be it. So things had not changed. And I think both men knew that by January 1900. And there's a little background to this. The man who was elected governor, William S. Taylor, the Republican from Butler County, he was sworn in and had already been serving for a month by the time the Democrats under William Goebel contested the election. And the politicians of Kentucky were in the capital of Frankfort, in a place called the Capitol Hotel, because hearings were being held upstairs to determine if a change was going to be made or Taylor was going to retain his office. That's why the politicians were there. And that's why Colson and Scott were both in the lobby at that time.
William Jennings Bryan was scheduled to speak as well. So it was a big deal.
Yeah, and it was very unfortunate because they say there were hundreds of people in this large lobby, and people were there because William Jennings Bryan was going to speak there that night. So the dining room was full, the politicians were filling the lobby, and there was a lot of people milling around. And so not a very good place for a shootout.
Right. So it's a very tense scene, and there's loud conversation, cigar smoke, bellhops, dashing around, lots of activity, waiters coming and going, bringing drinks and food. And both Colson and Scott are aware by this point that the other is in the hotel. So then it becomes a bit of a dance, right? Golden is there with Scott. Colson has his own friends, men that he's discussing politics and business with. And it's almost like a matter of time, right, before they meet.
I think so. And although, according to one of the bystanders, Colson was surprised to see Scott, kind of horrified as he looked up. And Scott was advancing on him and reaching into his coat for what turned out to be a .38 revolver. And he knew that this thing was about to happen. At the same time, he saw Golden coming at him from a different angle. And so, you know, another ambush. And he had armed himself with two guns. And the first one was a .44 target pistol, which he pulled out. And the shooting began.
Colson had gotten that second gun, right? Just a couple of days before.
Yes, he tried to prepare himself, and he borrowed the target pistol from a friend in Middlesboro before he left for Frankfort.
So they are aware of each other's presence, but in the minutes before they lock eyes, Scott and Golden, correct, step outside for some air or something, and someone overhears them talking about Colson.
Yeah, he says, whatever you do, don't let him get the drop on you. And Scott's reply was, he never has and he never will.
So Scott is very obviously gunning for a fight. It wasn't enough to get Colson once. He wants to do it again. But to do it in a crowded lobby, why there? Was Scott just so red hot that he was oblivious to the innocent bystanders around them?
I know he was drinking that morning in the hotel. So once again, you know, alcohol comes into play in his judgment.
Yeah. So they're coming at Colson. This time Colson is ready.
Yeah.
And he shoots. Can you walk through this for us step by step?
Yeah. So they shot each other in that initial double blast, I guess you would say. Colson was hit in the elbow, the left arm. He shot back, and then two more shots ran out. Golden did not participate. He got behind Scott, and then the immense crowd in this lobby was just trying to get out. People were screaming. Men were trying to come out the front doors, down the stairs. There was a basement, and then there was a stairway, a marble stairway going down to the basement. There was also doors into the dining room and the dining room corridor. People dropped to the tiled floor. They tried to slither away. Women fainted. Waiters dropped their trays of dishes. It was pandemonium as this was going on.
So one of the men who had been with Coulson, named Luther Demery, I think.
Yes, that's correct. He was from Shelbyville.
He gets pulled into the showdown by Scott.
Right. Coulson went behind a marble column, and these men knew what they were doing. They were experienced at this sort of thing, and they never stopped moving. They kind of slid to the left, I think. And as you said, it was almost like a dance. By this time, Scott was almost in Coulson's original place. You know, the two men had virtually traded places, and Scott grabbed Demery. And while, you know, this shooting has produced an immense amount of gunpowder haze, he was using him as a shield and shooting from behind him. Coulson fired, and he hit Demery in the chest and also Scott. And Scott went backward, and Demery kind of slid down his body to the floor. And then Scott finds himself in the corner of the lobby, and it was kind of like a two-second break. They stared at each other, and Coulson put down his spent .44 and took up his .38 Smith & Wesson, and Scott knew he was outgunned and tried to get away.
But he didn't.
No, he didn't. A reporter said with a wild, scared look on his face, he began trying to make it to the basement steps. He fired his last shot over his shoulder, and here's where you get to legality. This shootout was over. Scott had fired his last shot. I'm not sure Coulson knew that, but Coulson took deliberate aim, shot him, Scott, in the back of the head, and pitched his body down the stairs. He reloaded, left the hotel, walked a half block to the home of Frankfort Police Chief Mason Williams, and surrendered.
Someone else was killed too, right? There were
yes.
two.
Yes. So Charles Julian is an interesting case. He and a friend, a neighbor, wanted to see William Jennings Bryan. And his neighbor talked Julian into going with him. And they went to the hotel to buy tickets to see Bryan that evening. And Julian was in the lobby when the shooting started and was shot in the calf, which was not thought to be a serious wound. The management was anxious to get the people who were shot out of the lobby and took him to a room, and doctors didn't know he was there, and he bled to death before he could be saved. And his friends believed that he was shot by Scott and not Coulson. Golden was shot in the, he got a shot in the back, and he sat on the floor next to former Governor McCreary waiting for a doctor. There was also an interesting story. A man named O.D. Redpath was a traveling salesman from Chicago. And when the shooting started, he tried to jump over the balustrade of the stairway. He tried to jump a half flight of stairs and broke his leg. So he was at the bottom of the landing when Scott's dead body landed on top of him. And his quote was, I had dis and once again, Kentucky's reputation. I had disobeyed my wife's injunction in coming here. I had not been here 3 minutes till I was shot at, had a dead man fall on me and broke my leg. I want to go home.
I would have thought the same thing. So Luther Demery, the friend of Coulson's who Scott used as a shield and Coulson shot, what happened to him?
Well, he died. The coroner's report said that he was shot 3 times in the chest, all within about the size of a silver dollar. And Colson, at some point, I don't know if it was in the trial or in the newspapers, said that he was trying to shoot around him through the haze. And it really is difficult for us to understand today just what this black powder haze was like. You know, it was like a fog, and it was difficult to see. And I believe that Colson could see, you know, an outline of where he was shooting, but I'm not sure he was aware that Demery, where he was at any given moment.
And Demery's brother arrives, right? Not long after.
Yeah, his brother, I mean, within a few minutes, he found a group of men in a circle standing over his body, and he said, "Oh, Luther, speak to me." And he said, "This has got to be a mistake. He never harmed anyone in his life." And so, he didn't understand exactly what had happened and didn't know until later that he was an innocent bystander.
So what happens to Colson after he turns himself in?
Well, he's now got a shattered left elbow and arm. He remains in the police chief's home, where doctors are working on it. One of his former men was J.L. McCoy, who had been in the Hatfield and McCoy, which began when he was 12. And his quote to McCoy was, "He ought to have been satisfied with what he had already done. I do not see why he didn't leave me alone." He was taken to jail at Frankfort, and he awaited whatever was going to happen. He was visited by the soon-to-be new governor, William Goebel, the Democrat, and Colson and Goebel were friends, despite party differences. And they say that he received about 50 telegrams and letters a day of people offering their help, congressmen who were attorneys who offered to defend him for nothing. But there was a backlash as well, and local newspapers and national newspapers taking cues from the local newspapers were commenting on Kentucky's reputation as a wild place, and politicians settling their differences, with guns. So that criticism was there. And a Louisville Evening Post editorial tried to defend Colson. And one of the quotes is, "Scott and Colson were enemies. Each should have known that the law would protect him against the other. But as a matter of fact, each knew that the law would not protect him. The law at least administered in our state. Kentucky has made each man his own guardian." There's an interesting sidelight here. There was a reporter that came to the scene. He was not there when it happened, and he ran around trying to get quotes, which he sent off to New York newspapers. And he became something of a celebrity because of this, and built a career on it. He was a writer in New York, a noted humorist. His name was Irvin S. Cobb. He was even in the movies in the 1930s. So this was really his entree into journalism and beyond.
Interesting. So there is a trial, right?
Yes. There was a trial that April. It was attended by lots of people. Major Sam Morrow, who had been in the 4th, who was one of the governor's nephews, he testified in favor of Colson. And he was acquitted in 18 minutes.
Wow. Goodness.
So he goes home to Middlesboro. And I think everybody wanted him to be better, but he just wasn't. They say he was never the same. He married a woman he met in Lexington during the mustering in. Her name was Ethel Elliott from Texas and Tennessee. He moved to a large home in Middlesboro. He tried to practice law. He never was able to use the left arm very well. His eyesight was failing, and he suffered mental anguish. He said that every time he closed his eyes, he could see the hatred in Scott's eyes. He thought he was that the situation was not over, that Scott's friends or relatives would try to avenge him. They say he grew thoughtful and eccentric. And then in September 1904, he was riding a horse, and the horse got frightened, and Colson was so upset that he shot the horse and tried to get into his house, and he fell at the foot of the stairs. And he died the next morning of nervous prostration, and he died at 43.
Wow. Were there any long-term repercussions in Kentucky, politics-wise?
I think people just shook their heads and moved on. This was big news around the state, of course. The local newspaper had three black framed columns showing mourning. The headline was called Colson, a native oak, storm wrecked. In that same newspaper was the Republican paper's choice for president, which is Theodore Roosevelt, who had boosted his political career, leading the Rough Riders in Cuba during the war. And of course, one of the most interesting presidents of the United States. Both of these men tried to further their political careers, and one succeeded spectacularly and the other didn't.
And he, of course, is still remembered by your family.
Yes. As I said, there were family stories about him all the time that I was growing up, and my great uncle, whose name was William Gillis Colson, who was named for Colson's brother, William Gillis Colson. He knew a lot about it, and he had talked to people, you know, who knew firsthand, and very interesting man to talk to, and really motivated me to tell the story myself.
The hotel where all of this happened, does it still exist?
No, it's, it burned several years after the event. There is a small building, a small portion of the building was salvaged. And so it today is called the Capital City Museum, next door to the old, what's called the old train station. And so a portion of the building does exist, but it's very small compared to what the Capitol Hotel was. Another Capitol Hotel rose from those ashes, and I think today it is used as a bank. Some of the artifacts that belong to Colson and the Colson family of Middlesboro are in the Capitol City Museum.
Oh, interesting.
I did find that there's a copy of sorts of the old Capitol Hotel that's still standing in Cleveland. And I've always wanted to go see that and walk around that lobby to kind of get a feel for what the Capitol Hotel lobby was in January of 1900.
Oh, cool. So as we've already established, this story you've told today is not from a book you've written, but instead an article. But you are, of course, an author. So can you tell us a bit about some of the books you've written?
Well, I want to tell Kentucky's stories. That's kind of been my focus. I wrote a book about University of Kentucky sports in the early 2000s. It's called First Cats. And the idea is that the firsts in the program, it's still the winningest basketball program in the nation. And there's a lot of interest in the people and places and events in the program. So I wrote that as kind of a test, really, to kind of see about the process of writing books. The second one I did is called True Bluegrass Stories. It's also available on Amazon. It's about the bluegrass region of Kentucky, which is the counties around Lexington. Lots of stories, interesting people and places. And in 2019, I wrote Civil War Game Changers, which is about Kentucky and Kentuckians in the Civil War. And it was astounding to me how many people, Kentuckians, helped Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War in one way or another. Lots of interesting stories there. And that was really a lot of fun to do. And I enjoyed learning, you know, more about it. It's really a story that has so far been untold. And I enjoyed telling it.
Well, cool. So great to have you on. Thank you for your time.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Again, my guest has been Thomas E. Stevens. He has written numerous books about Kentucky history. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.